Joshua chapter number 4. Joshua chapter number 4. And have so much going on the next several weeks, several months as we get ready for Vacation Bible School in 2 weeks. That's hard to believe. 2 weeks from tonight, we'll be in Vacation Bible School mode and looking forward to that. And three straight Wednesday nights. We've never done it this way before. We might not ever do it this way again. But we're doing three straight Wednesday nights and really just a focus on the family for those three Wednesdays. And a family VBS God's crew, and looking forward. This is not just drop your kids off and go for a date at Chick-fil-A and then come back and pick them up 2 hours later. We want you to stay and have something for everyone those three Wednesdays, and it's going to be exciting, and looking forward to being together with families. Joshua chapter 4. Remember, when we get to Joshua 4, we've already seen so much how that God is leading the people into the promised land. We saw in Joshua chapter number 1 how God spoke to Joshua, told him to be strong and courageous. At the end of the chapter, the people reinforced their commitment to Joshua, even though he probably had some doubts about it. As just like we were with Moses, we're going to be with you, Joshua. And it wasn't very comforting, but by the end of the chapter, they reinforced what God had said. Just be strong and courageous and we'll follow you. When we get to chapter number 2, we saw that the spies went into Jericho, that first principal city in Canaan, the first city that would oppose the Israelites and they would have to come against in battle. We saw how Rahab shared with the spies, this is what our people think about your God, and how they were encouraged. They went back to Joshua and said, hey, it's finally time. And it encouraged Joshua that the time was then. Then in chapter 3, we saw how God commanded Joshua and the people to go across the Jordan River and to step into the water. And as soon as the priest's feet touched the edge of the river, the waters parted, just like the Red Sea experience, and how they watched all of the people go across on dry ground. We're going to see in chapter number 5, next week, how they weren't the only people who heard about the Jordan River parting. But when we get to chapter number 4, we see that we're kind of getting ready to go over. They've already started passing over, and there are some instructions that they're given, a strange command that's a little bit further explained as we go throughout the chapter, but it causes them to start asking a few questions. It causes them to ask questions of the why. What did God do? What was his purpose? Why did he bring us here in the first place? But it wasn't just a question that they would be asking. God tells Joshua a message to share to the people and says, hey, one day your kids are going to ask about this. What will you say then? And it causes us to ask ourselves tonight, what are some things in our life that God has done for us that we need to pass on to our kids? What are some things that God has shown to us? Have we shared those things with our children? We talked last week about the fact that God doesn't just give us things just to hold on to for ourselves. He desires us to share those with other people. Paul told Timothy in 2 Timothy chapter 2, the things that thou hast heard of me among many witnesses, the same commit thou to faithful men who shall be able to teach others also. There is a principle of sharing what God has done in our lives. So tonight, as we read through this passage in Joshua chapter 4, we have to ask ourselves, what has God done for us that he expects me to share with someone else? Has God done anything in your life? Henry Blackaby, in his book Experiencing God, talked about the spiritual markers of our life that we ought to be able to look back and say, God was there and he was there and he was there. And we ought to be able to say, hey, I've seen God work. I know he works because I can look back and see signs, evidence. We sing that song, sang it last week. I see the evidence all around how he's been all over my life. But what have we shared with the next generation? What signs can you and I point to as those visual markers for the next generation to see, for our children to see, to know that, hey, God worked with mom and dad's life. God worked in grandma and grandpa's life. And so I know that God can work in my life because of what I've seen him do and what I've heard others share. And it's a wonderful question to ask us. Could it be that our faith isn't what it needs to be for them to see anything different than the world is sharing with them? You know, we talk about, man, woe is me, my life is miserable, my life is horrible, and we paint this bleak picture of Christianity for our kids to see. It's got to be more than that, guys. It has to be more exciting because they can get that bleak picture in the world. You know, the woe is me, gloom and doom, nothing's going to be good. You know, the world offers no hope, no certainty, no peace, no confidence, no trust, no faith, and no future. And the world's perspective is as long as you're happy in the now and now, that's all that matters. But what about when you die? What about when we check out of this life? There is more to life than this. There is more to our story than where we currently are. And that connects into our faith in a holy God. You know, Aristotle said it like this: happiness depends upon yourselves. See, this world view that we live in of a humanistic culture, this is not new. This is not something that just happened last year or has just happened since COVID, okay? We like to hang a lot of stuff on COVID that COVID isn't to blame for. But this is not a new concept. Marcus Aurelius, the Roman emperor from thousands of years ago, a couple thousand years ago, said this: very little is needed to make a happy life. It is all within yourself, in your way of thinking. And the problem with that is that happiness is external and joy is internal. If somebody walked up to you after church tonight and said, I want to give you a gift, and they gave you $1,000, you'd be happy. You know, it wouldn't produce any joy in your life, but it would be happy. Hey, man, that's great. If you walked out of here and found out that you lost $1,000 while we were in church, you would not be happy. You know, it's all external. It's things on the outside. But joy is internal. And because of the external relief or the external feeling of happiness, it tells me that I'm not going to be happy all my life. There are going to be seasons where I'm not happy. There's going to be seasons when I'm not thrilled about my circumstances. I'm not thrilled about what's going on around me. And that's why my life has to be filled with joy and not happiness. There has to be more to it than just my surroundings. Remember Nehemiah, when they finished the wall in Nehemiah chapter 8 and verse 10, he said, for the joy of the Lord is your strength. Joy. There it is. How about Habakkuk chapter 3 in verse 18 when he said, yet I will rejoice in the Lord, I will joy in the God of my salvation. Paul said in Philippians chapter number 4, in verse number 4, rejoice in the Lord always, and again I say rejoice. We can have joy even when we don't have happiness. We can have joy in our heart even when we don't have happy circumstances around our life. It is possible as long as we have Him. So with all of that in mind, what is our responsibility of the visual markers in our life? Look at Joshua chapter number 4, verse number 1. We see what they took when they left the wilderness, coming into the promised land. We see first thing what they took. Look at verse 1. And it came to pass, when all the people were clean passed over Jordan, that the Lord spake unto Joshua, saying, take you 12 men out of the people, out of every man a tribe, out of every tribe a man, and command you them, saying, take you hence out of the midst of Jordan, out of the place where the priest's feet stood firm, 12 stones, and ye shall carry them over with you and leave them in the lodging place where ye shall lodge this night. Then Joshua called the 12 men whom he had prepared of the children of Israel out of every tribe of man. And Joshua said unto them, pass over before the ark of the Lord your God in the midst of Jordan, and take you up every man of you a stone upon his shoulder according to the number of the tribes of the children of Israel. Here it is, verse 6. That this may be a sign among you, that when your children ask their fathers in time to come, saying, what mean ye by these stones? Then ye shall answer them, that the waters of Jordan were cut off before the ark of the covenant of the Lord. When it passed over Jordan, the waters of Jordan were cut off. And these stones shall be for a memorial unto the children of Israel forever. Now, when we get to verse number 1, it's almost like we see a reverse back to a previous conversation. In chapter 3, in verse number 12, we saw how God spoke to Joshua and gave him the order to pull out one man from every tribe. He was told to get one person from all of the 12 tribes. So you've got one person from 12 tribes equals how many people, class? 12. Good. All right. Some of you are like, well, is that addition or multiplication? But think about this. The last time 12 men were chosen, the outcome was completely different. You remember back to the book of Numbers, and how they were chosen 12 men, every tribe. 10 were bad, 2 were good. You know that. Remember that story? How that all of a sudden you've got these 12 men who go into Canaan. They spy out the land. This happens years before. They come back. 2 men say, yes, let's go in. God is able to give it. Caleb and who was the other guy? Joshua was the other guy who went into the promised land. They said, yes, God is able. Let's go up at once and possess the land. And 10 men said, no, we can't do that. We've seen the giants there. We're going to be grasshoppers in their sight. And all of this stuff is bigger than us, stronger than us. We're not able to overcome. And they discouraged the people so much so that they all lost all faith and all confidence, not only in God, but also in the leadership that they had, and everything crumbled. Now, this time was different. God tells Joshua, I want you to get 12 men, and I'm sure this was reminiscent in Joshua's mind. Oh, no. What's going to happen now? You know, 12 men, here we go again. We're right at the edge. We finally got here, God. Don't tell me to do 12 men. We're finally here. But he says, pick 12 men, and I want you to be ready to do something that we've never done before. He says, I want you to go, and I want you to pick up a stone. Now, we're not talking about stones, okay? We're not talking about little rocks. We're talking about, you see how he tells the men to carry them. He says, you're going to carry them on your shoulder. Can you imagine a little guy carrying a little rock, you know, on his shoulder? This is a boulder. Pick up a stone, something large, something significant, and carry it over. It was going to be a marker, a memorial for God's faithfulness. They were going to carry it across. It was going to help immortalize what they had done and where they had been and what God had shown them. They were going to set them at a place called Gilgal. Gilgal was the first town that they would inhabit, the first place. It was about 1.5 miles from Jericho's walls. It was close enough where they could go to Jericho in 2 chapters. When they go to Jericho in chapter 6, it was close enough they could go to Jericho, do what they needed to do every single day, and go back home. So this is a place that God has provided. The name Gilgal means rolling. Now, please don't go there. They're taking stones to a place that means rolling, okay? And that's, all right, we're not going there. There's not a Mick Jagger spinoff, all right? But the spiritual connection of the rolling, Gilgal, rolling, signified you're finally in a place where all of the stuff that you've lived through in the past has rolled off. Everything that you've learned in the wilderness, tuck it all away. Don't think about it anymore. We're going forward. And for us today, we all need Gilgals in our own lives. We need places where we can go and we can, okay, all right, I'm moving forward. I'm not thinking about the past. I'm not going to worry about that. I can't change anything. I'm at Gilgal. I'm looking ahead. I'm looking ahead. I'm not looking behind anymore. I'm looking ahead. And their past was behind them. 430 years of slavery and bondage in Egypt. And now they are going to have a time period of freedom. Finally, they're going to get a time period where they can think about the future rather than the past. And for us today, we might feel like we're living in a wilderness environment right now, but the promised land is coming for the child of God one way or the other. There is a promised land coming. And we see in Colossians chapter 3, verse 1, if ye then be risen with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ sitteth on the right hand of God. Set your affection on things above, not on things on the earth. For ye are dead, and your life is hid with Christ in God. When Christ, who is our life, shall appear, then shall ye also appear with him in glory. Philippians chapter 3, and verse 20 and 21, for our conversation, our manner of life, the way that we live, our lifestyle, our conversation is in heaven, from whence also we look for the Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ, who shall change our vile body, that it may be fashioned like unto his glorious body, according to the working whereby he is able even to subdue all things unto himself. Joshua is telling them one day, the day is going to come when you're going to ask what's happened here. Why is this pile of stones here? Why is this so significant? And Joshua says, at that particular time, you are to look at your children and tell them what God has done. Hey, what have you told your kids that God has done for you? What have you told the next generation what God... And they don't have to be your kids. What have you told someone younger than you? You know, we see a principle in the New Testament of older teaching younger. Older men investing in younger men. Older women investing in younger women. We see that over and over. What have you shared with someone younger than you to invest in them? And to remind them, first of all, that God is real. You know, they're hearing every single day in the public school system that God doesn't exist and your life doesn't matter. And when you die, you're just dead. You're like Rover. You're dead all over. And when you stand before you and give an account, as long as you are happy, it's okay. There is no second life. There is nothing after this. And they're taught that God does not exist. And if God isn't real in our lives, how will they believe that he can be real in theirs? How can we expect them to carry on something that we feel passionate about if we're not sharing it with anybody else? There arose a generation, Judges chapter 2, that knew not the Lord. How is that possible? Because people stopped sharing who he was and what he had done. That's how it happens. And we're living in a generation close to that today. Close to that. Where people don't know anything about the God of the universe and the God of the Bible. Some of you are old enough to remember when you could go and you could talk about Jesus and everybody knew what you were talking about. You could mention Bible characters. I say that loosely. People from the Bible. You could talk about Moses and you could talk about Noah and you could talk about David. And people would be able to tell you some significant things about their lives from the Bible. We don't live in that culture today. And it's so easy for us to say, well, you know, kids today, they've got it too easy. Please don't ever tell a teenager that. Because we don't understand what it's like to have the world at our fingertips. We didn't grow up in a generation like that, church. Don't discount young people today. This is the most dangerous time to be alive for a young person. You know, we didn't have cell phones growing up. I remember that. I remember the phone that had the 400-foot cord, you know, that stretched one end of the house to the other. I remember that. Some of you guys, you can remember a time when you didn't have a phone or a television in your house. You think about all those things. This is the most dangerous generation as far as young people because of what they have access to. And we've got to make sure that they understand that there is a God who loves them and looks out for them. And it's got to be real to us. It can't just be something that they hear about on Sunday. It's got to be something that it's our life. This is who we are. It's not something we do. It's who we are. And he's got to be real to us. They're going to have to trust him to provide. Think about the fact that Joshua tells them, as you go through the river, you're going to pick up a stone. They had to trust that there were going to be stones there in the first place. They couldn't see them. This is the rainy season. This is when the water is at its highest point. They couldn't see the stones that they were going to be picking up. They just had to trust and believe in something that they couldn't see yet. You ever felt like you're there? Or maybe feel like you're there right now? Well, I've got to trust in something that I can't see. And that's where they were. Lisa Turkhurst said like this, God often works in the unseen. Just because we can't see it or feel it doesn't mean he isn't working. I love C.H. Spurgeon's quote. It's a popular song, and someone took it, put music to it, but I love this quote. God is too good to be unkind, and he is too wise to be mistaken. And when we cannot trace his hand, we must trust his heart. You're not always going to see God at work. But you can know that he is always at work. He is always at work. Think about when we get here to verse number 8. The children of Israel did so as Joshua commanded, took 12 stones out of the midst of the Jordan. The water parted. As they're walking through, going around the Ark of the Covenant, as they're walking by, they start picking up these stones that are now visible. But not only that, look at the rest of verse number 8. The Lord spake unto Joshua according to the number of the tribes, the children of Israel, carried them over with them in the place where they lodged and laid them down there. Verse 9, and Joshua set up 12 stones in the midst of Jordan. Now this is different. This is not the same pile of stones. They've got 12 guys going out, and as they're going out, Joshua is stopping along the way and he's picking up his own pile. Now why? You ever read a treasure map? Or maybe you've heard maybe an old treasure movie or something like this, and you've heard this expression, X marks the what? The spot. X marks the spot. Joshua is told to set a pile of stones in the exact spot that the priests were holding the Ark of the Covenant. Why? Because when the water goes down, or when the water ceases to be parted, you would never see them. So why is it so important that Joshua set up this pile of stones? Think about the time of the year. We already mentioned this is the rainy season. It wouldn't always be rainy season. There wouldn't always be high levels of water. At some point, that water level would dip down and you would see a pile of stones in the middle of the river. Strategically set up to make a pillar. Now, that doesn't just accidentally happen. Can you imagine Andy Griffith and Opie going to the river and throwing in their fishing rod or fishing line and being there and throwing in that line, and Opie saying, "Pa, what's the meaning of those rocks? What are those rocks for?" You know, whatever. And Andy having to share with Opie, this is what God did. You know, God did that. You know, we think that God just works in the high times of our life. But God also works in the low times of our life. Stuff grows in the valley a lot more prevalent than it does on the mountaintop. God uses those valleys to allow us to see Him at work. And we love the mountaintop experience. Yeah, Lord, I want to live for the mountaintop. But not much grows on the mountaintop. We need those valleys to teach us and to grow us and to strengthen our faith. I like what David said in Psalm 139, verse 7 through 10. He said, "Whither shall I go from thy spirit?" He says, "Where am I going to go where God isn't present?" He said, "Whither shall I flee from thy presence? If I ascend up into heaven, thou art there. If I make my bed in hell, behold, thou art there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost part of the sea, even there shall thy hand lead me and thy right hand shall hold me." No matter what season we're in, God is always going to be there. And we can always find something to remind ourselves that He's been at work. He is there. So we see what they took. But then number two, we see what they prepared for. Look at verse number 10. "For the priests which bear the ark stood in the midst of the Jordan until everything was finished that the Lord commanded Joshua to speak to the people, according to all that Moses had commanded Joshua, and the people hasted and passed over." Can you imagine? There were no selfie moments when they're going across the Jordan River. You know, and look, all right, get my picture, you get my picture. None of that. It says they ran. "We're going to die." You know, they're running, trying to get across the river. Remember, nobody, there were two people. Two. Joshua and Caleb, who were there to see the Red Sea parting. Two. Everybody else had just heard about the Red Sea. And so they didn't have that experience, that background. Oh yeah, God's done this before. They didn't know. So when the water parted and Joshua said, "Go," they go. And they went. And they hasted over. Verse 11, "It came to pass when all the people were clean passed over, that the ark of the Lord passed over, and the priests in the presence of the people." All these people take off. Now, this was not something that was Joshua's plan. God did everything God did everything He said He was going to do. The people did everything Joshua had commanded them to do. And God had given him peace even years before when they went to spy out the land. But this is years later. We should have been here 40 years ago, guys. But now we're just going over. But when the people were hesitant to believe that God could do the impossible, even with all they had seen up to that point, they still doubted. They weren't just kind of like moseying across of, "Oh, you know, we'll take our time. We'll get there when we get there." They ran. There was a slight sense of doubt even mixed with their faith. Yeah, we're going to walk across, but we're going to be in a hurry as we walk. You know, those mall power walkers, you know, they got their sneaks on. You know, they're going, you know, silver sneakers. They're gone. But isn't that how we live our life? Isn't that how we trust the Lord? And we think about our life, we think about, you know, a chair and our faith. I'll steal Boogie's chair. He won't mind. Y'all don't tell him. When we think about our faith, you know, there is no faith. I'm not exercising faith in this chair when I'm looking at it. I'm not exercising faith here. I'm not exercising faith here because I still got a lot of weight on my legs. I'm not exercising faith here. Not exercising faith here. Not exercising faith even here. It's not faith until we sit in the chair. You know, for us, you know, it's like the guy sitting on the airplane and he's sitting there with his feet up. And the lady said, "What are you doing?" And he said, I don't trust these things. I'm not putting my feet on it. I'm not putting my feet on the ground. I don't trust these things." And the lady's like, "What are you talking about? What is wrong with you?" He's on the airplane. But this is how we live our life. We say, "Well, you know, I trusted him to save me. But, you know, I don't know about my bills. Or, you know, I don't know about, you know, this circumstance over here, this medical issue I've got over here, this job situation over here. I don't know if I can trust the Lord for that. But, yeah, he saved my soul." If we can trust him to save our soul, what can we not trust him with? If he can save and keep the most precious thing we have, and we're sitting here like this with Jesus, we're our soul, why can't we trust him with everything else? And the people are showing a lack of faith. It's not faith in him unless I completely trust in his ability to do what I can't do. Hebrews 11, chapter 11, verse 1. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, expected, the evidence of things not seen. It's something I can grasp. If I can explain it, reason it, work it out, prove it, is it still faith? If I can do it on my own, it's not faith. And faith is not some mystical force like Star Wars, you know. Faith is this. It's believing that he is capable to provide what we need in the timing that he sees fit. That's faith. It's believing that he is capable to provide what we need in the timing that he sees fit. Because if I sit here and I'm like, "Okay, all right, God, I got this. I'm trusting you. But if you get in a bind, you tell me and I'll swoop in and save the day." Like Mighty Mouse or something. You know, I'll swoop in. That's not faith. Faith is being put in a position where we have no other alternative but to trust him. That's faith. Because if I can get involved and I can fix it on my own, that's not faith. If I can maneuver, I can work out the details, or I can manipulate this, I can do all that, that's not faith. Faith is when there is no other alternative. Anybody ever had to make a decision based on faith? Where it's like, "Hey, there is no plan B, C, D, or any other letter of the alphabet. It's got to be him." And that's exactly where he wants us to live all the time. "Well, Pastor, that's scary. Don't I know it? Because I'm a sheep too. And I got to exercise faith." It is a step. One step. It's taking the first step. Martin Luther King Jr. said, "Faith is taking the first step when you don't see the whole staircase." That's faith. It's trusting him. It tells us in verse 12 and 13 that there are 40,000 people. Look at verse 13. About 40,000 people prepared for war. They're not coming across to have a picnic. Says they were prepared for war. They're preparing for the fight of their lives. Just because they were going to the promised land did not mean that, just because it was a new place, just because it was a new experience, did not mean that there would not be battles involved. And just because we go to new places and have new experiences in our life does not mean that we're free from battles. Yay, God did something. That's awesome. Be on the lookout for the next battle because it's coming. You know when you are exempt from battles? When you die. That's when you're exempt from battles. It's been said about storms that you're either in one, just coming out of one, or getting ready to go in one. We live our life in battles, in storms, as a part of the Christian journey. And we live that journey by faith. The Christian life is not a cruise. It's full of conflict. It's not paradise. It's full of problems. That's why we're told Ephesians chapter 6, verse 13, wherefore take unto you the whole armor of God that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all to stand. And we're told 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 3 and 4, thou therefore endure hardness as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. No man that warreth entangleth himself with the affairs of this life, that he may please him who hath chosen him to be a soldier. And just because they did all these things, what they saw God do, it encouraged them, encouraged the people, they followed the leader God gave them. And it happened all because they were obedient. They simply did what God said. George Washington, first president, said this, the whole duty of man is summed up in obedience to God's will. And who said the founding fathers didn't have their head screwed on right? It's all summed up in the obedience to God's will. Are we obedient to his will? Are we trusting him? Are we having faith, exercising it? We see not only what they took, we see what they prepared for, and then we see what they left behind. Look at verse 15. And the Lord spake unto Joshua, saying, command the priests and that bear the ark of the testimony that they come up out of Jordan. Joshua therefore commanded the priests, saying, come ye up out of Jordan. And it came to pass when the priests that bear the ark of the covenant of the Lord were come out of the midst of Jordan, and the soles of the priests' feet were lifted up upon the dry land, that the waters of Jordan returned to their place and flowed all over his banks as they did before. Now they're on the other side of Jordan. The Lord speaks again. Joshua, this is what you're going to do. Have the priests come out. The priests and the ark were the only thing holding back the water. Once they stepped out of the water, just like when they stepped in, when their feet touched the water split. When their feet came out of the water went back and flowed over the banks again. You know what we see? They left all the past behind. The Jordan River was the dividing line. That was what they had to go over. It was the pathway of where they came from. Just like we talked about in the last message. Cortez, how he burned the ships in 1519 when he brought the men over from Spain to Mexico. He said, there's no turning back. We're not going back. We're going forward. They left everything behind. Remember Joshua chapter 3, verse 13. It shall come to pass as soon as the soles of the feet of the priests that bear the ark of the Lord of all the earth, shall rest in the waters of Jordan, that the waters of Jordan shall be cut off from the waters that come down from above. They shall stand upon a heap. It was an eerie reminder of the Red Sea in Exodus chapter 14, verse 13. The Lord and the Moses said unto the people, fear ye not, stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will show you this day. For the Egyptian whom ye have seen this day, ye shall see them again no more forever. The Lord shall fight for you, and ye shall hold your peace. The Lord is going to speak, and y'all are all going to shut up. That's what he's saying. Y'all aren't going to have anything to say, because the Lord is going to do something so big, you're not going to have a response. Aren't you excited about the fact that God does those things that are so big, and we have anything to say about it? You know why we don't have anything to say about it? Because we didn't have anything to do with it. It's not our work. It's his. And what was the end result of what they saw at the Red Sea? Exodus 14, 31. Israel saw the great work which the Lord did upon the Egyptians, and the people feared the Lord and believed the Lord and his servant Moses. It was the same thing with Joshua. When they got out of the Jordan River, they stepped back and said, look what God did. And that's where we need to live. It all came about through humble submission to the plan of the Lord. Remember what Jesus said, Luke 14, 11? Whosoever exalted himself shall be abased, and he that humbleth himself shall be exalted. 1 Peter 5, 5. Likewise, ye younger, submit yourselves unto the elder. Yea, all of you be subject one to another. Be clothed with humility, for God resisteth the proud and giveth grace to the humble. Every single one of us struggle with pride. All of us. None of us are exempt. You know when you are no longer struggling with your pride, when you're exempt from your pride? When you die. That's when you're no longer struggling with your pride. And we're all leading somebody. Husbands are leading their homes. Moms are leading their kids. Pastors lead churches. People lead other people. Are you leading with humility? That's where Joshua was. That's what Jesus showed the disciples in John 13, verse 14 and 15. He said, "If I then, your Lord and Master, have washed your feet, ye also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example that ye should do as I have done to you." I love this quote. If serving is below you, leadership is beyond you. If serving is below you, leadership is beyond you. And lastly, tonight, we see what they remembered. Look at verse 19. The people came up out of the Jordan on the 10th day of the first month and camped at Gilgal on the east border of Jericho. And those 12 stones which they took out of Jordan did Joshua pitch in Gilgal. And he spake unto the children of Israel, saying, "When your children shall ask their fathers in time to come, saying, what mean these stones? Then ye shall let your children know, saying, Israel came over this Jordan on dry land. For the Lord your God dried up the waters of Jordan from before you until you were passed over." Now here it is. "As the Lord your God did to the Red Sea, which he dried up from before us until we were gone over." Now, it was simply a picture. It was saying, this is what God did. When they ask, you tell them. When they say, what happened here? Why is this big pile of stone so significant? Why do people stop and take selfies in front of it? Why is this a big deal? It's because of what God did. It's because of what God did. But it put them where they were at a very specific time. It says in verse 19, the people came up out of Jordan on the 10th day of the first month. If you go back in the timeline from when they left Egypt, this is within 5 days of the 40-year anniversary. 5 days. This is 5 days before the 40-year anniversary of them leaving Egypt. Say, why is that significant? What did they do right before they walked out of Egypt? The Passover. They celebrated the Passover. 40 years minus 5 days. And God puts them across the Jordan River and says, hey guys, in 5 days, we're going to remember where we came from. Do you remember where you came from? Do you remember what God has done in your 40-year period of time? Do you remember what God has led you through? What's the meaning of these stones? Hey, these stones are from this act, but it's also a picture of another act that took place 40 years ago. See, worship comes before celebration. When Jericho fell in chapter 6 and 7, man, they were excited. They were celebrating. Woohoo! High five, chest bump. It's all good. But before we get there, we're going to stop and worship. You know what they were worshiping? They were worshiping the God who hadn't done yet what he said he was going to do. They were worshiping by faith in something that hadn't happened yet. When I see the blood, I'll pass over you. They had to act in faith. Hey, put these stones in this pile. Why? It's an act of faith. One day your kids are going to come and they're going to ask a question and you need to have a response. That's why. Act in faith. We're going to worship 5 days from now. We're going to worship and we're going to celebrate Passover as a group of people. And we'll see in chapter number 5 that they had a list of preparations to get done before they could do that. But Joshua says, hey guys, before we celebrate, we're going to worship. Before we rejoice, we're going to worship. It was that way in Ezra chapter 3, when they built an altar before they finished the work of the temple. It was that way, Exodus chapter 15 and verse number 1, right after the Red Sea, they said, hey, before we celebrate, we're going to sing praise to our God. It was that way in Genesis chapter 22 when Isaac was laid down on the altar. And before Abraham could go back and meet the two servants that came with him and celebrate and take Isaac back to Sarah, his mom, and explain for some weird reason, hey, I took our son and I almost killed him. Before that happened, they all worshiped. See, when God works in a miraculous way in our lives, do we jump for joy or do we hit our knees? What's our first response? Because worship should come before celebration. What's the meaning of these stones? It was a history lesson. That's all it was. This is what God has done. It required them not only to share what God had recently done, but also what he had done 40 years before, to tie the two together and say, this is what our God does. He provides. He takes care of us. That's what our kids need to hear from us. God provides. He takes care of us. Hey, God takes care of what belongs to him. That's why this is not our church. Because the minute we believe that it is our church, God will show us how wrong we are. The minute we think that we have our name on stuff, God takes it. God shows us when we say, God, this is not mine. This is not my work. It's not my legacy. It's not my namesake. This is yours. God takes care of what belongs to him. And God provides for what belongs to him, even when we don't see it yet. And that's where faith comes in. And that is how we're supposed to live our lives. Lamentations chapter 3, verse 22 and 23. It's of the Lord's mercies that we're not consumed because his compassions fail not. They're new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness. Hebrews 10, 23. Let us hold fast the profession of our faith without wavering. Why? For he is faithful that promised. We can hold fast our faith and hold on to him because he is faithful no matter what. 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 13. I love this. If we believe not, yet he abideth faithful because he cannot deny himself. It's who he is, not what he does. He is faithful. The last verse. Why? Why do we need to tell him? Why is it so important? Verse 24. That all the people of the earth might know the hand of the Lord, that it is mighty, that ye might fear the Lord your God forever. The whole point of this life is so that other people know about God's faithfulness, so that everyone knows. See, I would imagine that the issue is not the faithfulness of the Lord to us. It's the fact that we forget too quickly what he's done for us, or we forget quicker than we have opportunity to share what he's done. Hey, if we're continually sharing, we'll always remember. And so will everybody else. Are we sharing what God is doing for us? Father, we thank you so much for your word. And thank you for your reminders, Lord, that you are faithful. Lord, let us hold fast our profession of our faith without wavering, for he is faithful that promised. Lord, you are faithful. It's not something you do. It's who you are. Lord, I ask that you please help us to be people who live by faith. Not wavering, but Lord, fully committed to who you are. Lord, we love you so much. Thank you for reminding us of your love and your faithfulness. In Jesus' name, amen. We're getting ready to go to our prayer time, and let me give you just a couple things that you need to pray for before we go to our prayer time. Our missionary of the week is Brother Steve Rosenkrantz, Brother Steve and Miss Cindy, and they are missionaries to Jewish